Good morning again. So you may remember that we are in the middle of our summer series looking at the life of David. And if you were here 2 weeks ago, you'll remember that chapter 18 was full of Saul and his bitterness and anger and jealousy and some real wacky actions by Saul. In chapter 18, he tries to covertly kill David. And then in chapter 19, he doesn't care who knows and makes it widely known that he's running all over the country trying to kill David. David is helped to escape by Jonathan, who is Saul's son, as well as Michal, who is Saul's daughter and now David's wife. So both of Saul's kids are helping David escape. And then we end chapter 19 with this bizarre situation where David is with Samuel at Naoth.
Sure.
And Naoth is the huts or dwellings of a school or college of prophets over which Samuel presided. So there's these collection of buildings where prophets meet. And everyone who is there, all the prophets, has the Spirit of God come down upon them. And the Bible says they fell into a frenzy, whatever that means. So chapter 19 ends with Saul sending three groups of messengers to go and get David and to try to kill David. And after all three of those groups falling into a frenzy, Saul says, fine, I'm going to do it myself. And so he goes. He also falls into a frenzy, strips off his clothes, and is naked all day and all that night. Brueggemann describes the frenzy as, quote, "This behavior is understood to be caused by the invasive, compelling power of God who shatters all conventional categories of perception and conduct. The messengers are completely available for the celebration of and communion with God's Spirit. The practice effect of the experience is to cause the messengers to desist from their mission of apprehending David so that this odd experience, in fact, rescues him. The narrative suggests that God's transformative spirit is peculiarly allied with and attentive to David," unquote. And in this bizarre way, we see God rescuing David and saving David to be able to take the throne shortly. Once again, friends, we see the theme emerge from the story of David that God will use whatever, whomever, and however God wants to fulfill God's plans. So that leads us to chapter 20, which is what we're going to focus on today. And it's a beautiful chapter of friendship between Jonathan and David. In the first verse of chapter 20, we see that David trusts Jonathan. He goes to Jonathan and asks, "What have I done? If there is guilt in me, kill me yourself." He's essentially asking, "Why is your dad running all over the country trying to kill me?" And Jonathan reassures David, letting him know that if he hears any plan from his father to kill David, he'll be sure to tell Jonathan. He'll be sure to tell David. Verse 4 has Jonathan telling David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." And so we see this continual loyalty from Jonathan to David and not his father. So then Jonathan and David hatch plans to see what Saul is up to and where it is safe for David to go. Throughout this chapter, we see that Jonathan loves David as he loves his own life, or even more. Jonathan reassures David that the ties of friendship and his covenant with David, in this case, supersede family ties. Jonathan knows that Yahweh is at work to secure David and to destroy David's enemies. And Jonathan knows very well who David's prime enemy is. His prime enemy is his own father. So he and his heirs will be at risk when the harsh resolution is made between Saul and David. David and Jonathan are utterly committed to each other, and this love will survive in the face of David's vengeance against Saul and in his drive to secure his crown. This love on Jonathan's part is indeed an impressive example of the commandment of Leviticus 19:18 to love neighbor as you love yourself. And their deep commitment to each other is decisive for the future. So the friends that are now both in danger at the end of chapter 20, we have this beautiful place where they're saying goodbye to each other. And Jonathan says goodbye to David with a blessing, saying, "Go in peace, since both of us have sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between you and me and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" It's funny that Jonathan tells David to go in peace, because the peace cannot be referred to the present circumstances right now, because nobody's at peace. I just have this vision. They're running all over the country with Saul, with spears, trying to throw spears at David. That's the vision I get. When you read those chapters, that's what it sounds like. So there is not peace going on. Rather, that blessing is referring to the solidarity and reliability of their friendship and their covenant, which offers a peace the world cannot give or take away. Then Jonathan repeats the benediction of verse 23, "But now the stakes of binding are much higher. It is not just you and me, but our descendants forever and ever." There's something final and awesome about these words. It's as if Jonathan realizes that the tide has turned, and it doesn't just impact him and his future, but it'll impact the generations that follow. David is portrayed in chapter 20 as a man of steadfastness, and Jonathan is portrayed as this man who's making daring and costly choices. He has chosen David. He violates the command to honor his father. This is a stunning act of loyalty on Jonathan's part. I don't know if you remember, because 2 weeks ago we just skimmed the surface, but we talked about how Jonathan took off his armor and his robe and his sword and his belt, and he laid them at David's feet. And that was a way of Jonathan saying he's giving up all rights to the throne. He's putting it all on the line for David. So he's releasing his privilege, his lineage, his right to the throne. He's all of it. He has a lot to risk, and he puts it all out there for David. So chapter 20 exposes this gut-wrenching risk and pain and hurt, and also the hope that is required as God brings God's new reign. Jonathan sees this, knows God is at work, and he also knows that his dad has gone off the deep end. His dad is no longer a safe person, and Jonathan makes his choice. For those of us that have had to make difficult choices to create new family systems, I can relate to the gut-wrenching and difficulty that Jonathan has made here. There are times when our families of origin are no longer safe places for us to reside, and so we make choices. Choices to save ourselves and to make healthy choices for ourselves. And pray God's mercy. So this chapter has some profound things to say about friendship, and I want you, just in your head as you sit there, to consider if you have a friendship like that of Jonathan and David. Just and if you don't, you're not alone. So I was in preparing for this, I found I researched studies on loneliness. And a study came out of UC San Diego late December of 2018 that said 3 in 4 Americans experience high levels of loneliness. Also, loneliness appears to spike at different times throughout adulthood, in your late 20s, your mid-50s, and your late 80s. This was the first time since folks have been studying these kinds of things that 18 to 34-year-olds are more lonely than people over 55. They expanded on why some of these specific times of life are of particular times of loneliness for Americans. The late 20s are a time when people are making choices that will affect the rest of their lives, such as their career, their choice of life partner, and where they will settle. It really puts a lot of responsibility on you, Jeste said. It's a really difficult period, and when you compare yourself to others, you might feel as you're not doing as well as your peers. Mid-50s are times when people tend to experience a midlife crisis, as signs of aging highlight the fact that their time on earth is limited. You see some of your friends dying, sometimes family members, and you become aware of your mortality for the first time. The late 80s can be a time of increased helplessness. Half of the people at this age have dementia, and their physical abilities are in decline. Often you've lost your spouse, and you don't have many people left around you, either family or friends. It's really encouraging, huh? I highlight that to say, if you do feel like this, you're not alone. You're one of the 3 in 4. And we live in a time and a culture right now that is becoming more and more isolated. Using our technology to interface, as well as already living in a highly independent culture. A study goes on to say that loneliness has the same effect on mortality as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, which makes it even more dangerous than obesity. Quote Cigna, citing a 2010 report. Loneliness is crippling and dangerous to our health. I remember when Nathan and I were dating, and he would come to visit me from St. Louis. He'd have to board his dog because he couldn't think of a friend that would take care of her for a few days. And that was profound to me, particularly because I was coming from a situation, being here with you all, where you helped pay my mortgage for 6 months because my housemate died. So the contrast was stark. We all need a Jonathan, or several Jonathans. Dear friends that will stay by our side, who we trust completely, who is loyal and has our back. This last fall, Melanie Mock and I led a small group for folks talking about loneliness, and we discussed, at the end of the small group, we landed on the risk and the responsibility, the risk and vulnerability it takes to put yourself out there. So once you recognize you're lonely, then the next step is, what do I do about it, right? And so it takes an incredible amount of vulnerability and risk to put it out there, to start asking for friendship or asking someone to go have coffee, to take these steps to each other, because we risk rejection. But if we all stay in our own bubbles and don't reach out, then we risk missing out on this kind of friendship. We remain in our loneliness. The Jonathan and David friendships I have are ones that I can't imagine living without. They help me feel like I'm not alone here in this world. They're who I call when I'm feeling lost or bereft. And friends, there were years when I lived in that place. It was a little joke among our friends, like, Leslie's going through a hard time right now. We would throw that around because it was true. It was so true that we had a running joke about it. There were years when I was needy and I felt like a sponge and all I could do was take. And those friendships have hung in there with me. And that season has shifted. Now it's more of a reciprocal relationship. Build each other up and have each other's backs. And in the words of Proverbs 18:24, there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. These friends took risks and, like Jonathan, were gutsy and courageous and were there through thick and thin. Jonathan protects David at the expense of betraying his father. And we know that from chapter 20, Jonathan is aware that Yahweh is with David. And so part of Jonathan's friendship is faithfulness to God. He's not doing this off of some willy-nilly thing. It's clear to him that God has called and named David, and that Jonathan is going to have a part in that. Jonathan risks his own life, the throne, his family, his privilege, everything to swear alliance to David. Jonathan is a true friend who sees beyond his own interests. A lot of our relationships, especially in our Western culture, are of a utilitarian nature that is based on the usefulness of the person. We're friends for a little while and then lose interest and move on to someone else. Long-term commitment and devotion is rare. It is certainly true that in order to have a good friend, you need to be a good friend. If we want to have good friends in our lives, we need to work at being the kind of people who see beyond what someone can do for us. We need to be people that give of ourselves freely to others. And that's odd in a time and a place and a culture where folks live in a way that is naturally guarded, naturally suspicious if anyone offers this kind of friendship. Oftentimes, we need to be able to show loyalty before they will dare to be loyal to us. We can't wait for others to make the first move if we want some of these friends. We must dare to love and to care for one another. And some people will take advantage of our vulnerability. And some people may toss us aside when we are no longer of use to them. And this will hurt. And then hopefully, one or two people will dare to love us back. And they will become our friends. And that true and deep friendship will overshadow any pain suffered in the process, or at least lessen it. A friendship like the one Jonathan and David have is one worth risking for. And I believe this is part of why God created more than one person. When in Genesis, God said, "It is not good for humans to be alone." We're created for this community. We're created to rely on each other, to need each other. We do better in community. We are created to live life with others, to care for one another, to take risk for others, to support, encourage, and love each other. And so, friends, I ask us, as a church, do we live this kind of life? Do we create space for each other? Are we these kinds of friends to each other? As we enter our time of waiting worship, there's two queries up on the screen, if they're helpful. Are we friends to each other, modeling after Jonathan and David? And if you are experiencing loneliness, what might be the invitation from God for you today? If you have a message for all of us, I want to encourage you to stand so a microphone can be brought to you.